growth charts stump parents, pets keep the doctors away, and hospitals and younger visitors. Plus, we're going to take a look at cardiac medications. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. It's actually October 31st, Halloween night here in the U.S. Halloween night everywhere, really. But here in the U.S., you know, the kids are in their costumes and getting ready to roll out. I am putting this show out a day late because I was at the EMS Expo all week, drove back from Atlanta all night last night and got back very, very early this morning. So there was really no opportunity while on the road Friday to get a show uploaded. I was hoping to try to do something from the road down in Atlanta, but it just didn't work out. A lot of exciting things happened. In fact, I met some of my nursing listeners to the Medicast show. They also listen here to The Nursing Show. So I want to thank everybody that listens to both shows and came down to the EMS Expo and stopped by where we were doing our live shows and come by and visit myself and the other EMS podcasters that were down there. We're looking for an opportunity to do something like this for a nursing conference. It was a great time to talk with some of the speakers, some of the people from the different sessions, vendors from the exhibit hall, and bring all of that together, plus produce some great entertaining and informative podcasts while we were down there. And I want to thank my fellow ProMed Network podcasters, Greg Fries and Chris Montera, as well as Carissa O'Brien and Ms. Paramedic, the famous Ms. Paramedic from Twitter, for coming over and helping us out with all the things we had to get done in our booth. Of course, Ted Setla and Chris Eldridge as well for videotaping everything we had and editing the video we uploaded to emsexpo.net. Just a lot of fun and more stuff to be uploaded yet even now. So we're back in the saddle here in The Nursing Show, and I want to remind all of you that the information covered here can be followed up on with the resource links and other information I provide here in the show. The news articles and everything are linked in the show notes, and you should make sure you check out that information. I can only cover general information here on the show. It's your job to make sure you know how it applies specifically to your particular scope of practice, your particular guidelines and resources available to you in your facility, in your practice. And that's your job. I'll try to get the information awareness out to you. You need to follow up and get the more in-depth information. And I have links here to do that. Don't forget, you can find all of that over at nursingshow.com. And then if you have any comments or suggestions, and yes, definitely corrections, send them in to me here, comments@nursingshow.com, or leave a comment directly over on the show notes page itself. And that's what we call the Nursing Show community here at nursingshow.com. Time to jump into this week's news, and we'll start off with a look at some news regarding growth charts and the fact that parents just don't seem to understand what they're even looking at when they're shown pediatric growth charts by the child's pediatrician. And this is because they just don't understand what is being portrayed by the chart's curves and plotting system. Pediatric growth charts are usually used as a visual aid. They help doctors talk to patients about their child's growth. But if the parents don't understand what they're looking at and the doctor isn't explaining it adequately to them, this can cause, understandably, a lot of confusion. Studies actually showed that only 64% could correctly pinpoint the child's weight when shown a pediatric growth chart, and only up to 77% misinterpreted charts containing both height and weight measurements on the same chart. So certainly, it's great to have visual aids, but if those visual aids are confusing, misleading, or difficult to understand, it doesn't really supply any aid at all. Let's be honest here. Remember, you are a nurse in a pediatric office, to make sure that your patients and their parents are understanding what they're looking at and getting the information that they need from the physician. And if not, you may need to provide some follow-up education. Again, don't forget that basic principle of patient education in nursing, and understand the principles of something like ADPI, assess, diagnose, plan, implement, and then evaluate. And that evaluation portion is so important when you're talking about education, because you do need to double check and make sure that they understand. And not just by saying, did you understand? Because most people will say yes. They don't want to sound stupid. You have to make sure you take the lead here. And, you know, I know nurses are up to it. That's what we do. Next up, I'm sure this is something that is not a surprise to many people, but could you imagine if we could put something in a patient's home that would lower their blood pressure, encourage them to exercise, and improve their overall psychological health? Well, these might sound like some kind of amazing device, and this article leads off just that way. But in fact, we're talking about pets. And there are some information coming out of the University of Missouri College of Veterinary Medicine and their Research Center for Human-Animal Interaction. And that's got some kind of acronym for it, but I'm not even going to go there. But it looks at ways that people benefit from having animals actively involved as part of their lives. And what it found was that pets really have a large positive impact on people's mood, on their blood pressure, on their overall health. I think it just reduces their stress. It, again, encourages them to exercise, because you have to walk your pet. You have to take them outside. You have to get up and move around with them. The dog or the animal wants to play or do something. You can really have some positive benefits from having a pet. And we should understand this as nurses, because we have many patients that are living far away from family support. They don't have a lot of community support. And it is important for us to find some way to deal with loneliness and depression, especially in our elderly patients, as we send them home from a treatment program, send them home from a procedure, discharge them from the hospital. All of these things are important to understand, that when we send someone home alone, we can be dealing with a lot of post-facility depression, for lack of a better term. And I think that we could encourage, in an appropriate situation, a way to have a pet come into a patient's life if they don't already have one, or at least look at that as a possible intervention to encourage growth, to encourage a reduction in stress and a reduction in depression, and encourage the patient to exercise. So just look at this article. I have a link in the show notes. I think it's an excellent look at an unusual way we can encourage and help to treat our patients and get them back to a higher level of overall health. Finally, a look at hospitals. And, you know, I remember when I was a kid that you had to be a certain age to go visit someone in the hospital. So if you had a family member or a parent in the hospital, you had to be over 12. You had to be 13 or older to go visit someone in the hospital. Younger children were not allowed. That had relaxed, it seemed, at least in my experience in the facility. It seemed like some facilities had relaxed that requirement or relaxed it for certain places. But as we look at young visitors and look at the flu season and look at other things, there is some facilities are dialing back on their open visitation policies and really looking at ways to discourage children from coming to the hospital when it's cold and flu season, because so many kids are exposed to so many other kids and they can be carrying something with them that they are not aware about. So this is something that I wonder what your facilities are doing. Are you seeing a change in visitation practices? Maybe not even just limited to children, but visitation practices where you are asked to be more aware of the overall health of the people that are coming to visit your patients. If you see someone coming in that looks like they are sneezing or coughing or experiencing upper respiratory symptoms, they should not be around any of the other patients on your floor in these situations, even if they do have a relative they need to come visit. So don't forget to get back in touch with me. Let me know what's going on in your facility. I'd be curious to see if anyone else has seen a change in visitation policy regarding flu patients, respiratory illnesses in general, or age-related restrictions changed recently. Send me an email to comments@nursingshow.com. I'd love to hear what you have to say. it's time for our tip of the week. And let's jump right on in to this particular segment on cardiac medications. So let's look at the cardiac medications. We're going to look at three of the big cardiac medications, but there are other meds out there, and we'll talk very briefly about them. But let's look at the big three. They are beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and ACE inhibitors. Now, we also have digoxin that we still see quite frequently. I've covered digoxin in past episodes here on The Nursing Show, so you can check out those episodes if you'd like by just searching for them. We also have other medications, and this includes diuretics, it includes statins, it includes blood thinners and anticoagulants that patients may be on if they're a cardiac patient, and we see some different combinations of these at any given time. I just point them out, and I will briefly cover them at the end, but we're going to talk about the first three here and get started. So beta blockers, they are used to treat hypertension. They're also used, commonly seen in some facilities, used as a way to reduce cardiac oxygen demand on the heart by reducing that peripheral vasoconstriction, reducing that vascular resistance. They reduce afterload on the heart and also slow the heart rate down and all the way around reduce that oxygen demand. They work, as their name would imply, by blocking the beta receptors of the sympathetic nervous system. They decrease the heart rate, they decrease the contractility of the vasculature, and so we end up with a reduced blood pressure from this double hit. There is a side effect, of course, associated with that, is that they can't adequately respond with their sympathetic nervous system when they might need to. So patients who are on beta blockers are not going to show immediately increased heart rate as a sign of shock. So you're going to have to really watch for signs of skin condition, compromise, looking for signs of diaphoresis, paleness, or mottling. It's going to be a better earlier sign for these rather than heart rate alone. And if you know that they're on beta blockers and they even have a mildly elevated heart rate, that may also be an indicator. But just to be aware that that is not going to be a reliable sign for somebody taking a beta blocker. Also, beta blockers are very easy to recognize because they almost all end in LOL at the end. So for those of you that are texters out there or on Twitter or some other social media site and you're using LOL all the time, well, here you go. You can laugh out loud with beta blockers. That'll be your way to remember it. We have meds like metoprolol, atenolol, carvedilol, and sotalol. And if I've butchered those names, well, that's what they get for making them hard to pronounce. But in any case, you notice these all end in LOL, and that's one good way, easy way to recognize your beta blockers. Common side effects, drowsiness, weakness, or dizziness. Again, we're reducing blood pressure, so if someone stands up suddenly, they could experience a slowed filling of the blood vessels in the brain as they stand up and have that gravity pull happen to their blood. And so they could be suddenly weak or dizzy after suddenly standing or changing position. These patients are a fall risk. So if you have somebody that's just started taking beta blockers, a good educational point is make sure that they're aware of this and that they could be at risk for falls. To stand up in the change position at any time, give themselves a second to adjust. Their bodies will catch up, but it might take 1 or 2 seconds. So anytime they're moving or changing position, they should stop for a minute while they're holding on to something and give themselves a second to catch up. Again, these patients, you want to make sure you have fall precautions in place if necessary. You have to monitor these on a patient-by-patient basis. Another common occurrence is dry mucous membranes, and this is primarily the mouth or the eyes, but you should be aware of this and make sure that you're taking care of the patient's needs appropriately. We also see, because of the fact that it operates on the sympathetic nervous system, patients could, if they're not clearing the med out of their system fast enough, or they've taken too much of the medication, they could be experiencing over side effects or over effects of the med. You know, often our side effect is actually an intended effect that's been taken too far. So we have bradycardia and hypotension as potential side effects in beta blockers. And also, something I noted that I thought was interesting was restless sleep. And they could be drowsy, but when they do fall asleep, they might be unusually restless. And they might also talk of unusually vivid dreams. So if you see that, that is actually part of the side effect profile of beta blockers. We move on to calcium channel blockers, and you start to get an idea here that if you have a good understanding of the physiology of the cardiovascular system and how that works, you might have a better understanding of what each of these medications do just from their name. And calcium channel blockers are just that. They block the calcium channels in the smooth muscle and in the cardiac muscle. And so they reduce that squeeze that happens at the end of a contraction. It's that flow of calcium ions that maintains that contraction and pulls it even tighter. And so by reducing that squeeze, that contractility at the end of the heartbeat, they reduce the amount of blood pushed out, reducing blood pressure. They also have the same effect on the smooth muscle and in the vascular system, and so they reduce that constriction there as well. They will reduce the vascular tone, reduce the blood pressure. They also are used as a treatment for arrhythmias, commonly seen in patients that are suffering from atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter. You might see patients taking calcium channel blockers. And in fact, a calcium channel blocker could be used to treat an acute occurrence of a symptomatic atrial fibrillation that seems to be out of control and causing some forms of hypotension or compromise. We also will see that these medications don't have a common ending, so you're going to have to just know them. The good news is I really haven't seen too many more calcium channel blockers than what you have listed here. There might be a few, but these are the big three, so if you recognize these, you'll be good to go. And this is diltiazem, verapamil, and nifedipine. So these are your big three calcium channel blockers. Side effect profile is related often to, again, their intended effects. Tired feeling, patients are just going to complain of feeling generally tired. They also may complain of peripheral edema. Again, we're reducing that blood pressure, and so we're reducing the ability of the cardiovascular system to push fluid back to the heart, and so it's going to pull where gravity holds it, and usually in the lower extremities. So you need to watch for that and talk with your patients about how they can do certain things, a little more exercise or moving around to try to help encourage that fluid to get out of their lower extremities and back into the vascular system. They also may cause arrhythmias, and because they aren't directly affecting the sympathetic nervous system, they could be tachy or brady arrhythmias, tachycardias or bradycardias. So you need to pay attention to what you're seeing and understand that it could be either or, and understand that it may be related to calcium channel blockers. They can also complain of peripheral numbness or tingling, and these are two GI effects that occurred kind of high in the side effect profile, so I include them here. I don't always include GI side effects because nearly every medication has some, but constipation and nausea have also been complained of. Next up is ACE inhibitors. ACE inhibitors, ACE stands for angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitors. If you think about the renin-angiotensin cycle, this is inhibiting the progression of that cycle, and that's used to retain fluid. So when the cycle is blocked, and that part of the endocrine system is blocked, you end up with encouraging the release of fluid. So this is an indirect, I almost think of this as an indirect diuretic. It works by just not letting the body hold on to fluid when it thinks it needs to. This is a treatment for hypertension, also a treatment for patients who have congestive heart failure. And there's been some studies I've seen and research that talks about a positive effect on patients immediately following an MI when they are receiving ACE inhibitors. So you may see it added to a patient's drug profile then. This will decrease sodium levels. We're getting rid of fluids, so it's going to decrease our sodium levels. So we need to monitor sodium and all of our electrolytes. We want to watch our sodium and potassium levels most importantly, but you know, we want to make sure we're keeping an eye on our labs. Good news about ACE inhibitors, they end in PRIL, PRIL. So just like the beta blockers did, these have a recognizable ending. And if you remember that ending, you can recognize ACE inhibitors when they show up in their generic names, captopril, enalapril, lisinopril, and benazepril. And so that's something that will help you recognize these meds when you see them in a patient's list. side effects. The most prevalent side effect, the one that most people hear about, is the ACE cough. It's a dry, persistent cough that's very commonly seen in patients taking ACE inhibitors. It's annoying and in some cases may cause a provider to move to a different prescription medication for these particular patients. And we'll talk a little bit about that when we get to that other medication section at the very end. Another side effect is a headache. Also, dizziness or fainting spells. So again, that fall risk could come into play here. Again, we're reducing blood pressure, and we could see that that will have an effect on the patient. Another side effect that I've seen complained about in the literature is metallic taste in their mouth. And so they're gonna feel like, you know, like they've got a fork in their mouth and they're tasting that stainless steel taste. That's something that they might complain of. Again, peripheral edema, and there is some sensitivity to sunlight. So we want to let people know to wear long sleeves, use appropriate sunscreen, and protect their skin while taking this medication. So what about other cardiac meds? We talked about digoxin. It's an antiarrhythmic medication, and we've covered digoxin in another episode, so I urge you to check out and search out that other episode here on The Nursing Show. Also, statins. Statin drugs are medications patients take to control or lower their cholesterol. Most common of these is the brand name Lipitor, but there are others out there. Angiotensin II receptor blockers. Remember, I talked about an alternative to the ACE inhibitors. This is a newer blood pressure medication that's out on the market right now. And so you may see this medication. I know people will take the medication Benicar, for instance, is one of these. And it's an angiotensin II receptor blocker. It's part of that renin angiotensin cycle, but it actually breaks the cycle in another location and seems to not have some of the ACE inhibitor side effects that we've seen. But it's a newer medication, and some insurance companies may not pay for it. So this may be something that is considered a second-line drug after others have failed. Anticoagulants and blood thinners are often seen in cardiac patients. So you might have patients that are taking warfarin. A patient in a facility may be getting heparin injections, or if they're out of the facility, may be injecting themselves with something like Lovenox. Blood thinners such as aspirin are commonly seen in cardiac patients. Once they become a cardiac patient, patients may be encouraged to take aspirin every single day. And this is going to mean that they're going to be slow to clot. And when you try to start an IV on them, you may find that it's difficult to stop bleeding if you are unsuccessful in that IV attempt. Other common medications, nitrates, such as nitroglycerin. Patients may be taking this themselves. And in the case of an acute myocardial infarction and other cardiac signs and symptoms, morphine might be used as well, and for its vasodilatory effect as well as its analgesic effects. Finally, diuretics are often combined with any of these other medications to help keep the body's fluids out of the system and encouraging us to void them out. And the most common old line medications are furosemide and hydrochlorothiazide. Again, with any diuretic, even the potassium-sparing diuretics, I think it's really important to monitor your electrolyte levels, but especially your potassium levels for some of these older meds. So those are your other cardiac meds, and we've covered some of them in other episodes, so you can look up those as well. I had some additional references and resources here for you, so you can look up exactly where I got some of this information. I particularly recommend the National Heart, Lung, Blood Institute and the U.S. NIH Medline Encyclopedia, both great resources for you to use. And that's going to wrap up this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I want to remind everybody that you need to check back in for the show notes for everything discussed in this episode. All of the news items, tip files, and other links mentioned are all available in the show notes for this and every other episode. And you need to follow up on the information, because I can provide only general information here. It's your job to follow the links and look at the resources and see how they apply to your own scope of practice. I'll do my job here and get you as much information as I can. It's your job to follow up, make sure that the information gels with what you know and what you're supposed to be doing in your area. I'd like to urge all of you to comment and get back in touch with me here at The Nursing Show. You can reach me, of course, by leaving comments over at nursingshow.com. There are comment links at the bottom or near the top of every single article. You can also reach me by email, comments@nursingshow.com. And you can also get a hold of me over at Facebook, facebook.com/podmedic, or you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/podmedic. That's it for me. I'm going to close out the show, as I always do, with some PodSafe music from the PodSafe Music Network. Music.podshow.com is where you can find that. And this is a song I've played before. It's kind of, I don't know, guess the podcaster's anthem from a couple of years ago. Still a good song. Love it. Every now and then, pull that out and play it. My kids enjoy this song. It's Jeff Smith and Not on the Radio. You can find more music by Jeff on iTunes and other places. There's links in the show notes. Let him know you heard it here on The Nursing Show. That's it for me. I want to remind you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I also want to remind you to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.
Told me you're in San Francisco. They said you're working in a box,
yeah, cubicle.
Somebody told me that you're not on top of the world. You're probably walking down the street with your earbuds jammed so deep in your ear,
yeah, you're going deaf.
You probably found this little MP3 for free. Way cooler out there,
yeah, I think so.
But maybe you just like it in your cozy little world. Well, you can play this, but not on the radio. I made this just so I can let it go. Does anyone around here still have a radio? Out in Wheeling, West Virginia, we can make it on our own,
and we're doing just fine.
I can't afford your record, but it's out of sight. Well, you can play this, but not on